Start. So we're recording now. It is Tuesday, May 5th, and we're going to do the titration lab, and we're going to talk about solutions for a minute. No concentrations yet. Okay, well then let's talk about concentration for a little bit first before we get going with titration. You talked about ionic versus covalent dissolution. That's as far as you got. Okay. Thanks, Mary. Thank you, Sarah. That is extraordinarily helpful to know kind of where I need to start off. So let's look at solutions in a little more detail. And I'm going to swap out my glasses. My other glasses. And everybody can see my screen share, okay, right? The other day I started off and I hadn't shared the screen properly, or my app sort of glitched and didn't go through right. Looks like you guys can see it because I can see it up there. Okay, cool. So what you covered today was you covered things that were ionic in nature. Let's say like a solid that may be sodium chloride. And this sodium chloride, using a small s to indicate a solid, is a combination of cations and anions in regular repeating patterns in the solid. And so in these regular repeating patterns, what can happen is a water molecule, when you put this into water, can knock into this and knock out one of the cations or one of the anions. So we'll say this is a sodium cation that has been knocked out away from the crystal structure and is going into solution. And the water molecules will surround this and hold it in solution in a pattern that we call solvating. And this happens because of the polarity of the water molecule, because the water molecule is partial minus and partial positive in terms of its dipole moment. And so what's happening is all the partial minuses are lining up around the sodium ion to keep the sodium ion in solution. And the chloride ions, when they get knocked off, the same thing happens, but the water molecules orient in a different orientation to allow the partial positives of the hydrogen ions or the hydrogen atoms on the water molecules to bind to the chloride and to support the chloride with partial positive charge. And so the chloride feels like it's surrounded by partial positive, which helps to offset its negative charge. And the sodium ion is surrounded by partial negative in order to offset its partial positive charge. And this process, as we look at this process, we call this the dissolving process, or dissociation is the term that we use. So when we put it into water, we get dissociation. And so the ions dissociate, meaning that when I look at a container, if I have a beaker of water and I add in the sodium chloride, that the ions that are within that water are completely dissociated from one another and freely floating about the volume of the container, free to float around and move in any direction that they want, surrounded by their water molecules that continue to move and migrate around. And so this is the idea of an ionic solution. With dissociated ions. And we also sometimes call this an electrolytic solution. And we call it an electrolytic solution because if we were to take this solution and to pass electricity through it, it would conduct electricity. In fact, what we find is that electrolytic solutions, because of the movement of ions, when we take and we put an electrode into this solution and one side is positive and one side is negative of this electrode. And we hook this up to a light bulb and some sort of socket here. And we pass electricity into it. And we plug this thing in, and electricity comes out the other side and goes into the wire. And we plug this thing in. So that what has to happen is electricity has to pass through the electrode, and these two wires basically are hooked in here together. And so no electricity can flow unless the solution conducts electricity. What we find is that the chloride ions, the anions, will migrate towards the positive electrode, and the sodium cations will migrate towards the negative electrode, and the light will shine, will turn on. And we can use the intensity of the light to know about how many ions there are in solution. So if the light is very bright, that means that the solution is highly conducting. That means that there are many ions in solution. And if the light is very dim, then there are very few ions in solution. And so we can tell whether something is a strong electrolyte or a weak electrolyte. And we correlate those terms, strong electrolyte, to equal many ions in solution. And this many ions in solution also means that it is completely dissociated. A weak electrolyte Weak electrolyte means few ions in solution. And that means that it is only partly dissociated. So what do I mean partly dissociated? If we take a look at two sort of equations here, we can use a few equations to kind of show the difference. That if I take sodium chloride, something that is a very water-soluble salt, and I add it into water, what I find is that it goes into sodium ions, which are aqueous, and chloride ions, which are aqueous, and it does this 100%. And so that is a strong electrolyte and completely dissociated. A weak electrolyte would be something that does not dissociate completely. So let me choose something that is not going to completely dissociate. Maybe what we want to do is something like ferric hydroxide. And this would be a solid. And hydroxide, with various metals, is not very soluble. And so when we put this into water, this goes back to the solubility table, which you guys already learned in terms of solubility, that what we would get is we would get ferric ions, and we would get three hydroxide ions. These would become aqueous. But the way that we show that this is not going 100% is to take the arrow and do a very small arrow in the forwards direction, but a large arrow in the backwards direction, which means that this side is major. And we can think about this almost like an equilibrium, where I have the amount of material that is on the reactant side and the amount of material which is on the product side. And what we're saying is that there are many more of the ferric chlorides that are stuck together, that are solids, that are actually dissolving in the water. And so this would not be 100% dissociated. This might be only like 3% dissociated. And that means that the other side would be 97% solid. And that would be a weak electrolyte, not very many ions in solution because of that. So we can look at the ways that different materials dissociate. And we can measure that by the conductivity of the solution itself. So we can tell how many ions there are in solution based on actually the conductivity in the aqueous solution. And there's one other type of solution that we need to talk about, and that is materials that are molecular in nature, things that are like sugar. Sugar molecules, if we draw them, are a complicated sort of three-dimensional structure. And this is the structure of a simple sugar called glucose. It is one half of the sugar molecule that we eat, that is sucrose. Sucrose is a disaccharide. This one is just half of that molecule, D-glucose, but it's the sugar molecule that your brain uses for food. It's the only source that your brain can use for food, which is kind of cool. When we take this as a solid and we dissolve it into water, we find that it does not dissociate at all, that it stays what is called molecular, and it dissolves in water by a different process than dissociation. So there's more than one way for things to dissolve into water. One way is for them to dissociate. The other way is for them to do hydrogen bonding or dipole-dipole interactions with the water molecules. And the hydrogen bonding then allows this molecule to dissolve into water as a molecule, not dissociating into ions. And so this type of model is what we would say, non-electrolyte. So this is a non-electrolyte. And that non-electrolyte means that it does not conduct electricity. It dissolves as a molecule rather than an ion. Okay, so as we place things into solution, one of the ways that we make solutions is that we will take and use a piece of glassware called a volumetric flask. And the volumetric flask has a mark on it that gives a specific volume. So let's say that this is 100.0 milliliters, and that's the 100.0 milliliter mark. What we typically do when we make a solution whether it be an electrolytic solution or a non-electrolyte solution, is we, number one, weigh out a solid. Let's say that we're going to make a solution here of sodium chloride, and so we're going to weigh out sodium chloride solid, and this is going to be maybe 0.236 grams worth of solid. We take that solid on a piece of weighing paper that we've weighed it out on, and we throw the solid into this container such that the solid is now sitting down in the bottom of the flask. So we add solid to the flask. Next thing that we do is we add water to the flask, or whatever solvent it is that we're going to use, add water to the mark. And so once we add water to this, we're very carefully fill it up just to the mark of 100 milliliters. And then we cap this thing and we mix it and we dissolve it entirely. And what winds up happening here is that when we cap it, the neck of the flask is designed to give us what's called a mixing bubble. And so now that it's been filled to the mark, when we put a stopper into this and we turn it upside down and we shake this thing back and forth, what we get is a mixing bubble that this amount of air that is down in here drives this direction and allows us to actually mix this thing, because you have an air bubble that causes a lot of turbulence within the entire flask. And so we turn it upside down and we shake the darn thing. And once we get it all dissolved, then we have a solution and we can measure that solution's concentration. So I'm going to get rid of that. And we now have a homogeneous solution. And our solution was made by dissolving 0.236 grams of sodium chloride into 100 mils, not of water, but 100 mils of solution. So this here is 100.0 milliliters of solution. And inside this, we have now our 0.236 grams of sodium chloride. And that's in 100 milliliters of solution. And what we can do is we can calculate out a concentration. And the concentration that we choose to use is called moles per liter. So what we're going to do is convert the grams into moles and the milliliters into liters. And so we need the molar mass of sodium chloride. And sodium is 23, chloride is 35.45 plus, I'm going to get a periodic table really quick and get sodium because I can't remember, but it's 22.99. There we go. So it's 58.44. So for every 58.44 grams of sodium chloride, I get one mole of sodium chloride. And for every 1,000 milliliters, I get 1 liter of solution. And so in doing this, my grams of sodium chloride are canceling, my milliliters of solution are canceling, and I'm left with moles over liters. And that's a unit that we call molarity, moles per liter. And so this comes out to 0.236 divided by 58.44. Divided by 100 times 1,000, this comes out to 0.04, I need 3 sig figs based on the numbers I did, 0.04 moles sodium chloride per liter solution. And we generally write this in a couple of different ways. One way to write this is to write the number 0.0404 moles per liter sodium chloride, or we can write it 0.0404 with a capital M and an underscore sodium chloride. The capital M with the underscore means units of moles per liter. It's a symbol for molarity, and so this is molarity. Molarity is just a measure of concentration. It's the amount of solute in a given volume of solution. So if we take and we define molarity, molarity is a measure of concentration in moles of solute per liter of solution. And it's important that this is liters of solution and not the liters of liquid that we apply to it. So when we think about these different terms, the solute equals the material dissolving. The solvent equals the liquid dissolved in. And the solution is the solute plus the solvent. So when we're measuring per liter of solution, we're measuring the total volume of the entire contents, not just the liquid. It's the liquid plus the solid that has gone into it. And that is the total volume that we're measuring. And then molarities, concentrations, can be used in order to deliver a specific amount of a material and gets us right into stoichiometry because it's in moles per volume. So we don't have to go through mass in order to get to moles. We never have to use molar masses. The great thing about molarities is that the molarity allows us to be able to use a volume to get to moles of a material. For instance, let's look at how we use molarities. So when we have a given container, if we take that volumetric flask that we have now filled up that has that specific solution in it, and we had 0.0404 moles per liter, so this was 0.0404 moles per liter of sodium chloride, and I want to take and I want to just put some of that material into a beaker, and then I'm going to want to know how many moles I actually put into the beaker. So let's take out of this and measure out of this a quantity that is maybe 25.00 milliliters. And we want to know how many moles of sodium chloride are in this volume of 25 milliliters. Well, what we can do is we can use the molarity as a conversion factor. It allows us to convert from volume to moles. And so we can go from milliliters of solution to liters of solution. And then from liters of solution, we can use the molarity to convert into moles of sodium chloride. So this is sort of our roadmap of how things are going to work out. And this conversion factor here, that arrow is represented by this conversion factor, which is our molarity. So we go through and we take and we just write it out, 25.00 milliliters of solution. And we'll multiply by a conversion factor that takes us from milliliters to liters. And we'll keep the word solution in there until we make the transition, which we're about to do. So this conversion factor that I'm writing right now is the molarity. For every 1 liter of solution, I'm getting 0.0404 moles of sodium chloride. That's my conversion factor, that is that last arrow. And now, as I go through and cancel out units, milliliters cancel, liters of solution cancel, and I'm left with just moles of sodium chloride. So it's 25 divided by 1,000 times 0.0404. So this would be 0.00101 moles of sodium chloride. Okay, so we could also ask if we wanted a certain number of moles of sodium chloride, how much solution would I actually need in order to get that amount? So another sort of example here is to say, what if a reaction requires maybe 0.0200 moles of sodium chloride? How many milliliters of 0.0404 molar solution will be needed? This one, we just turn it in reverse. Now we're going from moles of sodium chloride, and we use the molarity to convert from the moles to the liters of sodium chloride, or the liters of solution, and then from the liters of solution, we convert to the milliliters of solution. So we just turn the equation around and do it in reverse. So we start off with the number of moles, 0.0200 moles, sodium chloride. And then I multiply by the molarity. So for every 0.0404 moles, it requires 1 liter of solution. For every liter of solution, I get 1,000 milliliters. And so I just go through and do that math now, canceling out the units, moles of sodium chloride, liters of solution, and I'm left with milliliters of solution, 0.02 divided by 0.0404 times 1,000. This would be 495 milliliters of that solution. Required in order to be able to do that. Let's see, 0.02, 0.04, I did everything correctly. And we'll just check, yep, everything's good. So basically what we find is that the molarity allows us to convert between moles of solute and volume specifically in liters of solution. But we can get to other volumes as we need to. And the molarity allows us to go back and forth. When we take a look at our stoichiometric roadmap, sorry, my app crashed, restarting real quick. When we take a look at our general stoichiometry roadmap, one of the things that we find in that roadmap was that we had the mole bridge where we went from moles of A to moles of B. And we called this the mole bridge. Lucas and Elizabeth may have other names for it. Sometimes they call it a subway, or sometimes they call it, I don't know, they have different names for it. I always call it a mole bridge. And from moles of B, we were able to go out to grams of B, and we were able to go from grams of A, and we could go out to other mass units. For B, and we could come from other mass units of A. So this was our general stoichiometry roadmap. One of the things that molarity allows us to do now is that the molarity, if we do think about solution sort of as aqueous and in blue, that we can go from a liters of solution A using the molarity, the moles per liter, as a conversion factor to get us into moles of A. And from moles of B, I can come back out of this, and I can go from moles of B back out to liters of solution B using the molarity, moles per liter, of that solution. And it allows me not to have to go through mass and not to have to calculate molar mass. Molar mass is no longer needed for these two. And it's not needed because it's baked into the molarity in moles per liter. So I can go back and forth between volumes and moles. And there was other ways to get in and out of this as well. I don't know if you remembered, but we could have started if A was not a solution but was a liquid, and we had a volume such as in milliliters. If I had milliliters of A and A was a liquid, then in order to get into grams, I needed to use the density of A, the grams per milliliter, in order to get there. Or if I wanted to get from B into volume of B, if B was a liquid, then I needed the density of B in grams per milliliter. That was another way that we got in. There was yet another way that we did this, sort of fleshing this out. I get excited at this point in the semester because now we've done almost all the material and we can kind of get that big picture. And I think at some point in the beginning of the semester, I actually wrote this on the board and showed this to you and said, this is where we're going. This is the bigger picture. But now it sort of all comes into focus that there was another way that I could choose to get in and out of this. And that is that I can use PV equals NRT, where N is the number of moles. And so if I have a pressure and I have a volume and I have a temperature of a gas, then I can use those variables to calculate the number of moles. And those moles can then go into a stoichiometry roadmap where I can actually do stoichiometry with that. Same sort of thing that if I come out with B, moles of B, then through PV equals NRT, I could come out with a pressure, a volume, a temperature, coming out with those number of moles. And I could tell you, given the volume and temperature, I could calculate out the pressure of whatever gas it is that's being produced, which is kind of cool. And so this is almost an entire stoichiometry roadmap, but really highlights out the part that we're going to do today. And the part that we're going to do today is using this piece down here of solutions through the stoichiometry roadmap, moles of A to moles of B, to be able to do some measurements, to be able to do some chemical reactions. So that's kind of where we're going today. Let me take a break and see how you guys are doing and ask if there's any sort of questions. Sarah's doing okay. Anybody else? Anybody have any questions that they want to ask so far? Just as I'm sort of giving an overview of where everything is going. Have I kind of picked it up where Sarah left off for the most part so that this is making sense? And okay, cool. That's helpful for me to kind of know where we're going. Okay, so let's try to take this a step further and let's look at an acid-base reaction and what happens with acid-base reactions. In an acid-base reaction, and we're going to link it to this roadmap. So we'll come back and we'll use this roadmap again when we do this acid-base reaction. We'll talk about how this is, what this is going to look like. In acids and bases follow the double displacement pattern of chemical reactions. The double displacement pattern were all of the precipitation reactions that we did earlier. Acids and bases follow that exact same pattern as the precipitation reactions. They're called double displacements. So when we look at an acid and base reaction, these reactions are classified as neutralizations. We take an acid, let's just do a simple one. Let's do HCl. This is the acid component. And we'll take a base like sodium hydroxide. And when they react together, they react together in the double displacement pattern. In other words, the cation of one goes with the anion of the other, and they swap partners in that way. And so as they swap partners, what I generate is sodium, the cation, and chloride, the anion. And so they come together in a one-to-one ratio, sodium chloride. And hydrogen is a cation, and hydroxide is an anion. And they come together in a one-to-one ratio, except I write it as H2O. I write it as water, combining the two hydrogens together to show that they come together. And so what has been generated is a salt and water. I've taken what was an acid and a base, and I have neutralized them to produce salt and water. This is a neutral solution, meaning that there is no acid and no base. And that's what I mean by a neutral solution. We can also say neutral solution when we define the pH system, which I'm not ready to define for you, but most of you have heard of the pH system and that the pH system has 7, runs from 0 on up to 14. It actually goes below 0 and above 14, but we usually stick, because of water, within 0 to 14. And at the 14 side, this is the basic side where there's base present. At zero, this is the acid side where there's acid present. And right smack in the middle, this is what we call neutral, where there is no acid and no base. And so this solution here, this neutral solution, is what we would say is pH 7, where there's no acid and no base left. That is a neutralization reaction. And so by definition, a neutralization reaction produces salt and a water, not always sodium chloride, but different types of salts. So we'll see that we can get various salts when we do neutralization reactions. Another example of a neutralization reaction might be the reaction of H2SO4 plus sodium hydroxide. Here what we have is we have an acid that when ionized produces two hydrogen ions and a sulfate ion, which is 2-. And so we can think about these as combinations of cations and anions. And the hydrogens that are here, the acidic hydrogens are always written on the left-hand side of an acid. So we always know how many protons are acidic by virtue of which hydrogens are being written in front of the equation. Acidic hydrogens always written on the left of formula. So for instance, HCl, H2SO4, H3PO4, there are three acidic hydrogens, HC2H3O2, there's only one. These protons that are inside are written inside because they are not acidic. So we can always tell how many acidic protons there are by the protons that are written on the left-hand side of the equation. And we're combining this with a sodium hydroxide, which is a sodium cation and a hydroxide anion. And so when we bring these together and swap the partners, sodium is going to go with the sulfate. So I make sodium sulfate. This is 2- and plus. And so it will require two sodiums to balance out the equation. So I will write Na2SO4. And the other equation that I'm writing is water combining with hydroxide. Those go together in a 1-to-1 ratio, the cation and the anion, and so I make H2O. But the equation, if we look at it, isn't balanced. The equation not being balanced can be seen or demonstrated easiest probably by the sodium, that if we look at how many sodiums there is only one sodium on this side of the equation, while there are two on this side of the equation. And if you notice the subscript 2 here as well, the two hydrogens, what winds up happening is that I need two sodium hydroxides and two waters in order to balance out this equation. And kind of watch what happens here. The two that is down in the denominator of this acid is the same as the two there, is the same as the two that is down there, is the same as the two that is in front of the water molecule. That the equation balances out with the subscripts and the coefficients in an easily predictable way to be able to see how the equation actually balances out. Let me show you one more using a triprotic acid, using H3PO4, and we can predict how to balance it. H3PO4, combining with sodium hydroxide, goes to make a salt, sodium phosphate, PO4, plus some number of waters. And when I take a look at the three that is right here, that three is going to need to be here. That three is going to need to be down here as a subscript. And that three is going to need to be there to balance out the number of water molecules. And it makes the formula balance. Why is this happening? It's happening because when I think about each one of the three hydrogen ions that are given off by this phosphate, and so here's my phosphate that has the three minus, then every hydroxide that is going to combine with that, I'm going to need three hydroxides in order to make each one of these water molecules. And so that's going to combine to make three water molecules. Well, for each one of those hydroxides, I also get a sodium that comes with it. And those are the three sodiums that match up with the phosphate in order to make the whole thing work. So when we're looking at acids and we're looking at the stoichiometry with acids and the way that acids and bases react, the way that we talk about an acid is an acid can be like this, monoprotic, meaning one hydrogen. It can be diprotic, meaning two hydrogens. Or triprotic. Oops, that should have been the phosphoric acid. H3PO4. So we get three hydrogens that come out of that. We can also do the same sort of concept with bases so that we can have a base. We can say that sodium hydroxide is monobasic. Meaning that it's got one hydroxide ion that comes with it. Calcium hydroxide, because of the 2+ charge on the calcium, is dibasic. It has two hydroxides that come with it. And we could do ferric hydroxide, which is tribasic, which has three hydroxide ions that come with it. So acids can be monoprotic, diprotic, triprotic. Bases can be monobasic, dibasic, tribasic. And how we combine them in terms of the formula in order to do neutralization always produces a salt and water. And then the equation needs to be balanced for the number of hydroxides and the number of protons in order to get the right number of water molecules. Okay, all of that is great. Let's look at doing an actual equation using molarities in order to do some stoichiometry. Okay, so let's take an equation that is the easy one. Let's start with HCl, adding together with sodium hydroxide, going to make sodium chloride and water. And what we're going to do is do the chemical reaction, and we're going to start off with some volume of HCl. So let's say that 0.026 liters of let's give it a concentration, let's say 1.50 moles per liter HCl is reacted with 0.025 moles per liter sodium hydroxide. I'm going to move this number over here. How many liters of solution are required to react with all of the HCl? So what we're asking is, and I always use my balanced chemical equation as my map for placing everything into the or for organizing my information, let's say it that way. So what I like to do is take, for the HCl, I have 0.026 liters of solution. And I have a concentration of 1.50 moles per liter. And under the sodium hydroxide, I'm asking how many liters of solution. So my question is liters, and my concentration is 0.025 moles per liter. Let's go grab that stoichiometry roadmap that we just made before and see how we can use that roadmap to figure out where we're going to go. Basically, what's happening here, though, is that these two numbers are dumping out moles of HCl. We are going to go from the moles of HCl to the moles of, that was supposed to be moles per liter, to the moles of, I don't want to do it just that way yet, to the moles of sodium hydroxide. And then from the moles of sodium hydroxide, using the molarity, we will calculate out the liters of solution that are required. So basically, on our stoichiometry roadmap that was all the way back up here, we'll grab this, we'll bring it down, and we're going to put it right here for a second. And then what we're going to do is map our reaction onto that and where we're going. So we're starting off with a liters of HCl, and we're starting off at this point in our roadmap. We are here with liters of HCl. And where we're going to go is we're going to go this way on our roadmap. Oops, that was not supposed to do that. We're going to go this way on our roadmap. We're going to go through the moles. This is going to be of HCl. We're going to go to the moles of sodium hydroxide, and then we're going to use the molarity of sodium hydroxide and dump out back down here. This is where we're going, is to liters of sodium hydroxide solution. And so we're going to follow that path on our roadmap, going through the mole bridge using these different molarities. And so let's take that and sort of map that out. So where we're going is liters of HCl. So this is our roadmap. We're going liters of HCl. We're going to go to the moles of HCl. And it is the molarity, the moles per liter, that are going to allow me to be that conversion factor. From the moles of HCl, I will go to the moles of sodium hydroxide. And that conversion factor is the stoichiometry. It's the one-to-one stoichiometry that is in my balanced chemical equation. So these are the coefficients. From the equation. From the moles of sodium hydroxide, I will go then to the liters of sodium hydroxide. And that conversion factor is my molarity, the moles per liter of the sodium hydroxide. And that's the entire road step. So it's taking one, oh, here we go, pointer. It's taking one, two, three arrows, three conversion factors. And those are my one, two, three conversion factors that I'm going through and doing this calculation. So let's put that all together and see how that looks. And because I want this to be cohesive, I'm going to copy it and drop it down here in a new page, or just at the bottom of this again, so that we can see this whole calculation as we go through and do it. I'll shrink it down just a little bit more. All right, so we start off our calculation with 0.026 liters HCl. We multiply by the molarity, by its conversion factor, that for every 1 liter of solution, I get 1.50 moles of HCl. Now I go through the coefficient part. So now I'm here, and I'm going to use this conversion factor going through the coefficients to the molarity, or to the moles of sodium hydroxide. So for every 1 mole of HCl, I get 1 mole of sodium hydroxide. Now I'm in the last part. Now I'm here and I need to go to liters of sodium hydroxide. So this is my last conversion factor, which is the molarity of sodium hydroxide, which is here. So I want to make sure that my units go right. So I'm going to have moles of sodium hydroxide in the denominator because I'm taking this moles and I'm wanting this to cancel. So these two need to cancel. So I'm doing that appropriately. And then the number of liters of sodium hydroxide is going to go in the numerator. And for every 1 liter, it is 0.025 moles. So we'll punch that in and we'll see what comes out. 0.026 times 1.5 divided by 0.025. And it's 1.56. It's almost the same amount. 1.56 liters of sodium hydroxide. However, I do have to be careful of sig figs. So based on the sig figs that I was given in the problem, there was 2 sig figs there, 3 in that one. 2 in that one, I need to round to 2 sig figs. And so my answer is going to be 1.6 liters of sodium hydroxide. That's how I would go through and do that type of calculation. All right. Well, what's cool about this, besides the fact that we are learning something new, but it fits in within an old paradigm. So it fits in within this roadmap that we've spent some time studying and we've spent some time with stoichiometry. And so stoichiometry shouldn't be so scary at this point, that it's just in and out of that mole bridge. And so we're going from measured values to counted values back to measured values. And that's why we go through that mole bridge, is because it's only the comparables of moles to moles that are counted values that allows us to be able to convert one substance into another substances, because the concentrations or the masses, all of those things are different for all the different materials. But when I go count to count, then I can compare directly. So if I have 5 shoes and 5 gloves, then I have the same number of shoes as gloves, regardless of them being totally different materials or weighing different amounts. And that's why we go through the counted values through the mole bridge. And while we can do these types of calculations of how much of one material is needed to neutralize another material, another great question is, how do I use one solution to measure the concentration of another solution? This is what is called a titration. Titration is where I use a solution of known concentration. This is called a titration. Gotta get it right. Titration. Titration is where we use a solution of known molarity to measure the molarity of an unknown solution. Such as an acid-base reaction. So in a titration, what we literally do is we take, and we'll just use the reaction that we're going to look at today for a minute. What we do is we take a solution of known concentration. So let's use sodium hydroxide as our known solution. So this one is an aqueous solution, and it has a known concentration, and we react it with some solution, in this case, acetic acid solution, of unknown concentration. And we know what the chemical reaction is between these two. We know that we produce salt and water, and the salt that we get is sodium acetate. So there's our sodium acetate, which stays aqueous, and we know that we get water, and that this is a monoprotic acid and a monobasic base, and so they go together in a one-to-one ratio. And what we're going to do is we are going to add the sodium hydroxide to the acetic acid. So we add this material to that material until we reach the neutralization point, until we get to a pH that is 7, where I know that I have just reacted enough sodium hydroxide to react to all of the acetic acid, and all that I have left is salt and water. And so we continue to add sodium hydroxide, measuring the volume. So we add this to the acetic acid until we hit pH 7, which is a neutralization. So now what I do is I know the concentration. So let's do these things in red that I know. I know the concentration. I know the volume that I've added. I know the volume of acid that I started with, so I have a volume of the unknown acid, and I know this volume that I started with, and I know that I've reached my pH of pH 7. The two things that are here, this guy, the concentration and the volume, tell me the moles of sodium hydroxide. The moles of sodium hydroxide must equal the moles of acetic acid because they're in a one-to-one relationship in the balanced chemical equation. And if I know the moles of acetic acid and I divide by the volume that I started with, this is the volume of starting acetic acid. Actually, I don't need to get that in there. I just say volume starting. Then this is equal to moles over liters, and that is molarity or concentration. And so essentially what I've done in a titration is the titration uses one solution of known concentration delivered to a solution of unknown concentration until an endpoint is reached, until the moles are equal. And then I can calculate out what the molarity of the unknown solution is. That's what a titration is. And it's generally done with acids and bases, but it can be done with other types of chemical reactions as well. So any reaction where we can visualize an endpoint and we can calculate the number of moles that have been added into a solution, and we start it off with a given volume, we can use as a titration, and we can calculate the original concentration of the unknown thing. So that's what our goal is to do in terms of of today's lab, is to go through and do a titration, and not only to do it once, but to do it three times, repeat it, and to calculate out the concentration of the unknown acid each time that we do it. Okay? All right, so let me stop again because you guys haven't asked any questions. So that makes me nervous when you're not asking any questions. It's either meaning that I'm doing a great job, which I'll take, but more often it means you're just not willing to ask just yet. So I want to make sure that it's not that I'm that good. I know that. I just want to make sure I'm giving you an opportunity to ask the questions. Emily's all right.
Can you just run through an example of another titration?
Yeah, you know, William, what we're going to do is I'm not going to run through an example of a titration. I'm going to do a titration. So we're actually going to see it, collect all the data, and run through the example of it. How does that sound?
That sounds even better.
Okay, so that's what we're going to do. That's where we're going to go from here. All right. So let me start that off then. So let's grab the equipment that we're going to need and then sort of put this thing together. All right. I had equipment going on over here someplace. I was doing all my drawings again. So we're going to grab all this equipment and we're going to put together a titration. So when we do a titration, we need some way to be able to measure all the different volumes and things. We won't shrink in that. That's not what I wanted to do. Let's see if I can put that back. Drop it there. Yeah, it's dropped in the right spot. Okay. So when we do a titration, we need equipment to be able to dispense volumes, measure volumes, and a way to be able to visualize the endpoint of the chemical reaction. We could use a pH meter. So a pH meter would tell us when we hit pH 7, but there's some easier ways than setting up an entire pH meter. Most of the time when you do a titration, you don't use a pH meter. They lag behind a little bit. They're not always as easy to use as some other chemical means of being able to visualize the endpoint. So the pieces here that we use are an Erlenmeyer flask. This is for the chemical reaction. So that's what we do the titration in. We have a burette, which is a piece of glassware that is made for measuring the dispensing of volumes. And it starts off up here at the beginning at 0.0 milliliters. When it's full, it reads zero. And when it's empty down here, it reads 50.00 milliliters. So this is a 50 milliliter burette. And you read the volume dispensed, not the volume contained within. I hope that makes sense. So I fill this thing up to zero and I will open up the stopcock and deliver a volume. And then I will read the final reading, and the difference from the start to the end tells me how much actually left the burette, tells me how much went into the chemical reaction. So that's what the burette is, and the burette, how the burette is used. We have a ring stand and a burette holder. So this thing is designed to hold the burette on the ring stand. And then we're going to have our standardized solution. A standardized solution is a solution that has been very carefully measured multiple times, three or more times, and averaged out to give you a very precise reading of what the molarity of that concentration of that solution is. So this is our standardized sodium hydroxide solution. This is essentially our ruler. It's what we're going to use as our measuring stick to measure the unknown solution. So then we have our unknown, which is going to be a commercial acetic acid solution. And we're going to just measure the concentration of acetic acid in that commercial solution. We're going to have a DI water bottle. And then we have an indicator down here. This indicator is labeled as PHEN. This is phenolphthalein. Phenolphthalein is a pH indicator of sorts. It is colorless when a solution is acidic. And the second the solution turns basic, it turns pink. In fact, it turns sort of this hot pink. And so it goes from colorless to pink as soon as the solution switches from acidic to basic. And it does it at pH 7. So if we put this pH indicator, this phenolphthalein, into our chemical reaction, as long as there is acid present, it will remain colorless. As soon as there is a slight excess of base, as soon as I have just hit the endpoint and I've hit the neutralization and there's a slight amount of base left over, the solution turns hot pink and I know that I've reached the endpoint of the titration. So these are all the pieces that we're going to use. And we're going to set up this reaction, and let's just go through and do that. So what we do is we take the Erlenmeyer flask, and we're going to dispense some acid into the Erlenmeyer flask. So we'll just take this guy down here, and we're going to hit the pump on this thing, and it's set up, let me see if I can zoom in, it's set up to deliver exactly 10 milliliters. So we've got the pump setting at 10 milliliters. All we need to do is depress this pump slowly, and it will dispense out 10 milliliters into our flask. So that's what we're going to do, is get that 10 milliliters, and then we'll take our flask down here that's now got 10 milliliters of the unknown acid in it. So we need a solution down here, and it's just got a small amount of volume because 10 milliliters is pretty small. So we start off by adding 10 milliliters of the unknown into the Erlenmeyer flask. And this is unknown HC2H3O2 into Erlenmeyer. The next thing that I like to do is I like to add deionized water to the flask. And this could be anywhere from approximately maybe 10 mils on up to 20 or 30 mils. And the reason that we do that is that it's very hard to do a titration with very little volume in here. And so basically all we do is we take and we add in some deionized water into this, just increasing the volume that allows us to be able to do the titration a little bit easier. The more volume there is, the color changes are a little bit easier to observe and we don't miss as much. So we just increase the volume a little bit by adding some water into that flask. Okay, I need that to go away. So now that we've added the water, now what we're going to do is we're going to set up our burette. So we're going to fill the burette. With the standardized sodium hydroxide solution. And filling the burette is the challenge, really. Trying to get the sodium hydroxide that comes in the bottle like this into the burette is really the challenging part. And what most people will do, and most chemistry instructors will instruct you to do, is to take and put a funnel up into this and pour this through the funnel into the burette while the burette is standing in the stand. The only problem with doing it that way is that when you pour a bottle into a funnel, something that's standing on a table that is very high, you are pouring this at the level of your eyes. And sodium hydroxide, if it gets into your eyes, if it splashes, it can damage your eyesight permanently. You can lose eyesight in both eyes by getting a strong sodium hydroxide solution in your eyes. So I never recommend pouring sodium hydroxide or any solution at face level. What I do instead is I grab this thing and hold it down at waist level, and I don't use a funnel. I just pour directly from the bottle into the burette. And normally in class, what I would have done is demoed it and showed you how we go through and do that. And then I have you repeat it and have you pour it and do it yourselves. And if you're nervous about doing it with the sodium hydroxide, then we just practice it with water in the same bottle that the sodium hydroxide comes in. We can practice pouring with water into the flask until you feel comfortable that you're not going to spill it. And then we go ahead and we make sure that the burette has all the water drained out of it. We rinse it with a little bit of sodium hydroxide to rinse all the water out, and then we fill it with sodium hydroxide. And then once it's filled with sodium hydroxide, then we go back to the table and put it back in the stand. So we're going to assume that we went through that entire process. We're going to put the burette in the stand, and we're going to just have this thing filled up to the zero mark and ready to go through and do the titration. So let's grab these two guys and say that we filled this up, and now we're getting set to do our titration down here. So I'm going to move a few things around. We'll leave that right there for now. We need to get rid of this water bottle. And we'll get this guy over here. So we have filled the burette and it is going to be placed in the stand. We'll put it all on the page over here, down close to the bottom. We'll get rid of these marks. And when we place this thing in the holder, essentially what happens is the holder is a pinch holder. You just kind of pinch it, and the burette fits right in the holder like that. And it just gets grabbed by the four little prongs that are on there. And this burette now is filled all the way to its zero mark with sodium hydroxide solution. So we've got that all filled up. And we're going to take and we're going to add in, I almost forgot, we need to add in our phenolphthalein. So we need to add in 4 drops of the phenolphthalein. This is the indicator. And so we grab one of these guys and we just put a couple of drops, into the Erlenmeyer flask. So it goes into here. We add the fin in and then the whole thing is ready to go. So what we have now is this is the standardized sodium hydroxide solution that is in the burette. Down here, we have the fin plus 20 milliliters of water, plus we have the 10 very carefully measured milliliters of acetic acid, HC2H3O2. And what we're going to do is we're going to measure the initial volume in the burette. And so this is measured at, we could say V1 equals 0.00 milliliters because we're starting off just at the very top. And then we're going to add sodium hydroxide carefully to the flask with swirling until the endpoint is reached. And so what happens is, as we add in the sodium hydroxide and we open up this valve and sodium hydroxide starts to go in, what winds up happening is sodium hydroxide is sort of dripping in here. We get a localized color of pink that sort of develops right where the sodium hydroxide is hitting. And as we swirl this, that pink color goes away. The pink color fades. And we continue in that fashion, adding and swirling and adding and swirling until such time as we get a persistent faint pink color. So what we're looking for, and this is going to just overly dramatize it because it's like so pink, there's no way I could lighten that up. We're looking for a very faint hint of pink. Maybe I can lighten it up. We're looking sort of the faintest hint of pink that we can get in this solution while not overdoing it. And that's the end point. And we will have dispensed a volume of sodium hydroxide. And we will then take a look at this and measure what that new volume is. And that new volume for us is going to come out to, I lost it, I wrote it, I did it someplace, 16 milliliters, it's 16 point something though. Let me find what I did with my, there it is, 16.32 milliliters. So this is going to be 16.32 milliliters at endpoint. So now number 7, we read the burette for the final volume. And the final volume here is going to be 16.32 milliliters of sodium hydroxide. the titration is now over. We've done the titration. What's left to do is to take down these recordings of these two volumes and the initial volume of acid that we used and the molarity of the sodium hydroxide. So we have the molarity of the sodium hydroxide, the initial volume of the unknown acid. We have our initial and final volumes of sodium hydroxide, and all of that now gets written into the chemical reaction, and we go through and we do the computation. So what we'll do is we'll write out the balanced chemical reaction, and then we'll write down all of our knowns and what it is we're going to try to solve for, and then put the whole thing together. So the chemical reaction that we are looking at is sodium hydroxide reacting with acetic acid, HC2H3O2, to form sodium acetate plus water. And states in these are kind of important too. So we should keep, everything in here should be aqueous, except for the water, which is a liquid. It's the only one that's different. And this chemical equation is balanced. It was a monoprotic acid and a monobasic base. And so everything is a one-to-one ratio. And we're gonna go and get the data that we collected. It was 0.5064 molar, 0.5064 moles per liter. That was the concentration. So our concentrations are listed. The concentration of the acetic acid is unknown. We had our volume. Our volume here started at 0.00 milliliters, and we are subtracting 16.. It is going to be volume final subtract volume initial, which is going to equal the volume of the sodium hydroxide. So we are going to start off with 16.32 milliliters, subtract 0.00 milliliters, because that was our starting spot. And that is going to equal 16.32 milliliters of sodium hydroxide that was used. And the amount of acetic acid was 10.00 milliliters. So now we have everything that we need, the three pieces of data that were required in order to do this were the concentration and the volume of sodium hydroxide and the volume of acetic acid. And what we are going to calculate is the moles per liter of acetic acid. And this can be done in a stepwise way or in an all-in-one equation. I always prefer to do it in an all-in-one equation, but I can certainly understand if we want to do it in a stepwise way. So let me map it out and kind of show what it is that we're going to do here. We are going to use the volume of sodium hydroxide. So we're going to use the milliliters of sodium hydroxide. And we're going to calculate out the liters of sodium hydroxide, so that we can use the molarity to convert into the moles of sodium hydroxide. From the moles of sodium hydroxide, I'll use the balanced chemical equation in order to get the moles of acetic acid, HC2H3O2. And once I get that, in another calculation, I'm going to take the milliliters of acetic acid, HC2H3O2, and I will convert those into liters of acetic acid. And if I divide these two, if I divide the moles by the liters, that will equal moles per liter. And that is the molarity that I am after. So each one of these conversion factors, what are each one of these conversion factors? Well, this conversion factor here is that there is 1,000 milliliters, which equals 1 liter. That is the same conversion factor that is being used here, 1,000 milliliters equals 1 liter. The conversion factor represented by this arrow is the molarity. This is my 0.5064 moles per liter for the sodium hydroxide. The conversion factor here is that it is 1 mole sodium hydroxide is equal to 1 mole of HC2H3O2. And that came from the balanced chemical equation. That came from these coefficients that are sitting in front of the balanced chemical equation. So now we have all of the conversion factors and we have our roadmap. We can go through and we can just plug in our numbers and then calculate out what our molarity of our solution is. So let's go through and do that. We're going to start off with our 16.32 milliliters of sodium hydroxide. And I'm going to put the word solution in there. And I'm going to divide it by the 10.00 milliliters of HC2H3O2, and that is also of that solution. And what I'm doing there is I'm taking and starting with my milliliters of sodium hydroxide divided by my milliliters of acetic acid. And now I'm going to work in the numerator first. So what we can actually do is we can go through and we can say, all right, this is my numerator. Let's color my numerator blue. And let's color my denominator red so that we can see these conversion factors as they relate into the equation that I'm about to develop. So that means that if I'm going to do that, then I want to start this off as blue. And I want to start this off as red. So that now everything matches up roadmap wise. And I will switch colors as I work on the numerator and do my numerator conversions. So for every 1,000 milliliters of sodium hydroxide, I get 1 liter of sodium hydroxide. For every 1 liter of sodium hydroxide, I'm getting a concentration of 0.5064 moles of sodium hydroxide. For every 1 mole of sodium hydroxide, I'm getting 1 mole of HCl. And now I've reached the end of my numerator, and I'm going to switch and work on my denominator. Now I need milliliters in the numerator to cancel the milliliters in the denominator, and I want to go to liters of HC2H3O2. And so for every 1,000 milliliters, I'll get 1 liter. And that's the end of my computation. If I go through and I check, milliliters are canceling. Liters of sodium hydroxide are canceling. Moles of sodium hydroxide are canceling. And my milliliters of acetic acid are canceling, and I'm left with moles of HCl. Ooh, you didn't stop me there. I made a mistake. That was not HCl. That was supposed to be HC2H3O2. And my liters of acetic acid. So I've got moles over liters, and that is molarity. That is what I want. So now it's just a matter of going through and punching in the values. 16.32 divided by 10 times 0.5064 times 1,000 divided by 1,000. So the thousands cancel out. So I don't really need to enter them, but I'll enter them anyway. And this comes out to a value that is 0.826448 moles per liter acetic acid, HC2H3O2. And I need to now figure out sig figs. So as always, the last step is to go through and look at our sig figs. In our measured quantity, there was 4 sig figs in the measured volume, both in the base and the acid. The 1,000 milliliters to a liter, that's a definition, so it doesn't apply into my sig figs rules. Concentrations are always measured. This is a 4 sig fig value in the concentration of my sodium hydroxide. The stoichiometric values of the 1-to-1 moles, these are counted values. Counted values do not affect sig figs, so those guys are considered to be infinite. And I'm back in definition again in my 1,000-to-1. So it looks like I've got 4 sig figs that I'm allowed to keep. And so the concentration that would be calculated here would be 0.8264 moles per liter acetic acid, HC2H3O2. And that would be trial number 1. Okay. How did that go? Did you guys follow kind of what was done there and the math and the way that it all worked out and the experiment and how it was all done? Okay, so to reset this, to do a second trial, what would be done is I would take and I would haze out the Erlenmeyer flask into the aqueous waste. So the Erlenmeyer then goes 8 to reset. The Erlenmeyer flask contents goes into the aqueous waste. And once I put that in the aqueous waste, I rinse it with water. And I rinse it a few times. I don't need to dry it, because what's going to happen is I'm going to go and I'm going to put in a measured amount of acid, and then I'm going to add water to it anyway. And the amount of water doesn't have to be carefully measured. And I didn't ask this, but why doesn't the amount of water, when I did this in up here and I went through this step, I added 10 milliliters of the unknown acid into the Erlenmeyer. Then I added DI water only to get the volume up to make the titration easier. How come I can add this water and I don't have to measure it carefully? The answer is that the 10 milliliters delivered the set number of moles of acetic acid, and that adding water to the flask does not change the original moles, nor does it change the original volume that those moles came in. All it does is increase the current volume, making it easier to do the titration. So the moles of acetic acid were set when I added these 10 milliliters, and those 10 milliliters is the volume that is used in my equation that goes in the denominator here that I am using to calculate through what my original concentration was. So the flask here, this flask doesn't need to be dry when I start off. I just need to be careful how I operate the pump vessel such that I depress this slowly so that it delivers an accurate volume of 10.00 milliliters. And then I'm able to go through and do the titration from there. So we reset. The Erlenmeyer flask contents goes in the aqueous waste. I rinse the flask with water, and then I start over and record new V1 on burette. Add 10 milliliters of acid to flask, add 3 drops of the fen, don't forget that or it doesn't turn pink, and then titrate to endpoint. And we do it again. Okay, so what I emailed out to you guys, and maybe I can share that from here. Let me see if I can share it from here. Actually, what I can do, if I'm tricky enough, I emailed this out as a PDF on its own, but I know what I want to do. Give me 1 second. I can figure this out. I need need to go to Dropbox where I put it, to the Chem3 lab, and open the PDF. And from the PDF, I can share it. And once I share it, I can airdrop it onto my iPad. And once it comes over onto the iPad, I can drop it into Notability and add it to my note. And then we can look at it right here. So this is what I emailed out to you. And it has trial number one. This trial we did in class. So this was the data that we acquired and we went through and we calculated out this molarity in this first trial. Then I give you instructions where we do trial two and I give you new data. And we do trial three where I give you new data. And so what I would like you to do, this is your homework for the week, is to complete trial two, calculating out the molarity, complete trial three, calculating out the molarity, and then average the three to give me the average moles per liter for the acetic acid. Once you get the average moles per liter, there's one other part which has you calculating the percent by mass of acetic acid in vinegar. And that really was just a commercial vinegar, the type that you would use in your kitchen in cooking. It was a commercial vinegar solution. We're going to calculate out the percent by mass acetic acid in vinegar. And I give you the calculation. So I don't feel that I need to walk through this exorbitantly because it's all right here. You take the moles per liter that you calculate as the average of the three trials. You use the molar mass and the density of the solution to go through and do a calculation where we get percent by mass, which is grams of acid over grams of solution. You multiply that by 100 and we'll come out with a percent here. That percent you can compare to your commercial vinegar on the shelf in your kitchen, if you have such a solution, or you could look it up on the internet and see what commercial vinegar normally comes out at to, and whether or not we did a good job in our titration in our three trials. So that's your homework. This is mailed out to you as a PDF, so you don't need to get it from my notes here, but I figured having it in the notes, because I post these and I'll post them right after class is over, will allow you to go back and look at the example and how we did the calculation and match it up to that trial one so that you can reproduce it and do exactly what you need to do for the other two trials. How does that sound? Does that sound doable for next Tuesday? Do you guys have any questions in terms of what we did today or where we're going or what we need to do? And was this helpful for what you did in lecture as well? Do you feel like you need any other things for lecture, any other help in the lecture component? All right, well, let's do this. That's all I had to present today in terms of the lab. You've got all the information, you've got it on email, you know what your due date is. This is due next Tuesday. I'll hang on the line. And if anybody wants to stay after, I am perfectly willing to stay around and help you with whatever questions you might have from lecture, or if you have some homework questions, or if there were specific things that you didn't get in lecture. I'm happy to cover some of those materials in a little more detail if you like. And other than that, thanks for joining me. And I hope that you guys are enjoying or get a chance to get out and get a walk in this beautiful sunshine that we've got today. And have a good weekend, and I'll see you next week. All right. And other than that, I'll stick around and be here if you have any more questions. All right. Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Mary. Thanks, you guys. Okay, so Crystal, so for the average, we add the three calculations and then divide by three. That is absolutely correct, Crystal. Yes, that's how you get the average. Add all three together and divide by three. You're welcome.